Hey, welcome to the Total Bitcoin Podcast Show. My name is Kiva Andavani. Really excited, looking forward to my next special guest. Her name is Elizabeth Prefontaine. Some of you might have already heard of her on Twitter or maybe even found her by accident, such as myself on LinkedIn. I found her content really, really fascinating. Her articles are succinct that she wrote. With it's called Stalled Innovation or Powerful Innovation Bitcoin or Why Bitcoin is Not a Security. So I'm not going to, dive into that too much detail. She's going to talk about that. I'm going to ask her, about the background, the journey, her epiphany until she found Bitcoin. And what I really love about her content and her, ethical principles and her vision and comprehension is her degree of ethical principles, the journey she took, from the old legacy system, or would it be investment, capital markets, institutions, where she was amongst other positions she had. It was one of it was head of wealth sales at BlackRock, which, as far as I know, is a multi-trillion-dollar institution. But so I'm going to ask her a lot of questions about what she thinks. I'm really excited to hear about her insights, would it be, the so-called alternative coins or shit coins, as we call them, or the legacy system of banks, central banks. Thanks again, to shout out to Thibaut Maréchal, my good friend of Canada. And and this is what really fascinates me, the personal stories also of people who come from the old legacy, with the capital investment institutions, into this new, totally evolutionary space of Bitcoin with principles such as vires in numeris, do not trust, verify. And so she's the founder of Economics, is an independent research and consultant firm dedicated to financial technologies. And to check it out for yourself, it's octonomics.com. Read her articles, definitely worth reading. And she says, according to her own website, more specifically interested in the fast evolving world of Bitcoin, its ecosystem and applications. And she's established as an independent. Octonomics is free from any legacy business models and offers an unencumbered perspective on the current and emerging trends. So check her website out, and we're looking forward. Without further ado, this is my interview with Elizabeth Prefontaine. She's also, a prolific speaker, keynote speaker, expert, researcher. And yeah, let me know what you think. If you have any questions, write me to hello@thetotalconnect.com. Follow me on Twitter, LinkedIn, Instagram, what have you, on YouTube. Give me a share. Retweet it, like, it would really help me. Thank you so much for your support and for listening. And also make sure you check out again the website and the articles, the blog of Elizabeth Prefontaine. You can also follow her on Twitter. It's @eprefon. That's EPREFON. We're going to put those in the show notes. Thank you so much for your support, for listening again. And without further ado, this is my interview with Elizabeth Prefontaine. Elizabeth, welcome to the show. Welcome to the Total Bitcoin Podcast Show. How are you doing?
Hi, great. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for your time. So listen, Elizabeth, I stumbled upon you, right? I mean, by accident, sort of on LinkedIn, and then I got introduced to your articles, and somehow, the world is really small. And by the way, our Bitcoin friend Thibaut Maréchal also said hi to you from Canada. And he forwarded one or two questions for you, but we can get that into that later. So I read all your articles, Elizabeth, on your website or blog, octonomics.com. And I was really thrilled. It was really succinct, stylishly, perfectly written, eloquently. It's amazing. So congratulations to your articles. Let me see if I can remember. So I read Why Bitcoin is Not a Security, Stalled Invention, part one and part two, and the third one was Powerful Innovation Bitcoin, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. Good. Thank you. Thank you so much for reading my content.
Yeah, I appreciate it. And I read each of those articles, I think, two or three times, not because it was like too difficult. It was really so succinct, so beautifully written. I think for anybody, because you come from, and we're going to get into that, and I'm going to let you, you know, introduce yourself and maybe give a brief introduction to what's your journey, because I find your journey to Bitcoin, because you come from the legacy business, capital, investment, market institutions. You also, as I heard, you know, I read, you also were once head of the wealth management, wealth sales at BlackRock, which is, I think, sort of a multi-trillion institution, right?
It's the largest asset management firm in the world, correct?
Yeah. So what I really find fascinating about your whole approach and your, you know, your ethos is you tried everything to bring a little bit more, I'm going to paraphrase this a little bit in my own words, bring a little bit, you know, or bring the real transparency and accountability and, you know, data transparency into, you know, into this digital world or into the capital investment world. Do you think that the picture that you've described in your articles, do you think that's just the tip of the iceberg? And the floor is yours, Elizabeth. Why don't you just tell a little bit my listeners your journey to Bitcoin, you know, what's your background and how do you, you know, where are you positioned right now in the space of Bitcoin?
Okay, I'll try to recap 25 years very succinctly and by highlighting what I think is most important. I started working in the financial service industry in 1994. That was right before the internet was mainstream. So I'm old enough to have cashed a physical coupon bond in a bank branch, but yet young enough to be interested in picked up on Bitcoin. So in between, that's about 25 years, and there's a lot of financial innovation. When I started initially, it was really oriented towards the client. It was hooray for the clients. It was like, how can we do more? And it was really about servicing the end customer. And it was a period, a very innovative period, like in the 1990s. And then I my career can be summarized as currently four component: traditional banking online, capital markets, swaps and bonds on the sell side, and investments, where I distributed both hedge funds and exchange traded funds. You alluded to the exchange traded funds at BlackRock, also is part of my background. So banking, capital markets, and investments. I saw an opportunity in the market to increase transparency for the retail customer, because initially it was really about serving the client well. And as I spent over 10 years interacting with the wealth management industry, I thought that there was not enough transparency both on the fees and on the accountability level. So I wanted to develop a fintech, like essentially a software that would have allowed to quantitatively and objectively assess the performance of investment advisors. All that I wanted was to have access to the data. And I got confronted to permissioned innovation, which is you need to ask permission to the bankers before you can even develop any products. So obviously I was naive from my part to think that the bankers would accept and welcome transparency on the very thing that their clients pay them to do. So they block the product, they block the project, and without data, a fintech cannot create. So I went to see the regulators, and I was also shocked to see that they don't really care. And open banking and all those themes, like it's going to go around and around and around, because you need to ask permission to innovate. And as I made that realization that there was no way I could be able to empower end customer with its data and with true objective accountability, like quant-based accountability. At the same time, I zoomed out and I said, this is a problem that's not a Canadian problem. It's a global problem. Like, it's not done anywhere. And then I started thinking that even if they wanted to, the IT infrastructure of the legacy banking system is fragmented, inconsistent, and it, the back end dates from before internet. So there are limitations. Even if they wanted to, there are like there's IT limitations. At the same time, I started studying Bitcoin. And when I saw this weird thing, I said to myself, whoa, like this is my entire financial career reinvented over there without me even noticing it. And I don't understand it all, but I see something that works. And I see something that really has no use for people like me. It's perfectly fine without any financial people getting involved. So that was very appealing to me because it was an opt-out and a hope that somewhere that permissionless innovation could occur. And to me, Bitcoin was the response to drastic transparency, like an elegant solution to drastic transparency, objective truth, mathematics, quantifiable. And so I jumped in the proverbial rabbit hole without even realizing how profound, rich, and vast the subject is. And that's it. That's me. A few years later, still absolutely passionate about what I'm seeing. And I think it's the fourth flag of my financial career, which I think I think Bitcoin is not yet fully understood, but from my personal point of view, the most interesting topic I've been able to, I'm grateful to be able to study this and witness it.
Right. I typed in your name into YouTube. I was looking for some interviews, English speaking interviews. So, but there were, I think, most of them in French on YouTube, at least, you know. I think I knew you have one or two English speaking podcasts you've already done. So it was hilarious because I was watching, I think it was sort of a mainstream TV discussion, but put on YouTube, where there was a pretty, a strong discussion going on, and you were trying, I don't speak French, but you were trying to explain what Bitcoin is. I think so, you know, and then I think one of the moderators said, interrupted you and said, well, I don't understand, or something like that in French, you know. So how systemic is this non-comprehension, or do you think it's more ignorance, or is it really for the old legacy, old school, you know, macro investors or people from the old legacy system? Is it do you think it's hard to understand, or, you know, notwithstanding the fact that it needs time and resources, energy to put into to learn, you know, to comprehend?
Oh, Bitcoin is not something you're going to understand in 10 minutes unless mm-hmm. you need it. If you have the luxury of time to say, oh yeah, blah 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 blah, it'll take time to understand, like at least 100 hours with directed studies. But it's not something like 10 minutes you can get. The 10 minutes thing, yeah, if you do need to use it, that's as fast as it is to set you up. But if you want to start using it, it's very fast and easy. But if you want to understand all the intricacies and how it works, then it's a more profound research. And yeah, I think that generally speaking, most people who have a tradition from the legacy system, they're stuck in their rat race. They're running day in, day out. They don't have the time to pause and learn something else. And I think that the narratives are narratives and buzzwords are easy to consume, and that the depth of the subject is not fully understood yet.
Right. No, you're correct. Like understanding how it works, that's a totally different field. But I wrote down a couple of points which I want to talk to you about. I mean, when you talk about like monetary properties to, you know, people in the to investors or legacy people, do they understand the unique monetary properties of Bitcoin, such as, you know, as you said also in the articles, predictability, limited supply, stability, absolute scarcity?
I don't think so. And there's two elements to your question. I think one element has to do with the common misconception or lack of knowledge. I could talk about that, and I could talk also about the monetary aspect. Mm-hmm. So which one do you want me to go first?
The last one.
Okay. Yeah. Well, it's difficult for people. I will separate people between regular people and investment advisor. Because generally speaking, like regular people did not receive an education about money or the intricacies of the financial system. And as a matter of fact, like you don't learn these things in school and don't even know how to do a budget. So I will say it's just there and they accept it as is and they don't question it. They don't have the background to. However, an investment advisor did receive an education about money, finance, and they were mostly trained in Keynesian economics. Mm-hmm. That is how fiat currencies are constructed. So concepts of hard and soft money are not part of the classical education curriculum, and the gold standard is just not discussed. So the concept of hard money is foreign to most of them. After all, the fiat monetary system serves the bankers extremely well. So why would they even question it? For example, in 2008, several banks around the world were bailed out with essentially money printing. But the layman person, the regular person, did not feel or see this because it did not have an impact on the amount of dollar in the bank statement. He still had the same amount of money in the bank. But the amount of dollar was increased because money was debased, which means more money printing. And this money was used to save the bankers from going under. So the money was taken from the people without people noticing it. So since bankers are making money on money, and investment advisors make money on assets, post-Great Financial Crisis, there was a major bull run because there was too much money chasing too few goods. And as a result, the price of assets experienced a steep run up, all favoring bankers and investment advisor. But what the regular people doesn't know is the Cantillon effect, which means like that money injection doesn't spread evenly and essentially favors those that are closer to the printing machine. So assets go up, but this favors only those who can have assets. So and price rise before the rest of the population receives any new money. And for that combination of people are not, say the regular people are not educated on money and they don't understand that money has evolved through time and the vested interest of bankers in that system. I think that this is why there's a some misconception or difficulty to understand money. And I'm not getting into the barter trade and the property of money itself. Money as a protocol is not understood.
Right. So you said the keyword banks because Tip asked me to ask you, you know, what do you think about, I mean, you are partially already answered about banks and, you know, the so-called shit coins, alternative, or whatever coins that are, there's not Bitcoin. What do you?
Well, I'm not sure of the link between banks and shitcoin. I'm not sure what Tib wanted
no,
to make.
No, there's no link, actually.
What's the link there?
Two different questions, probably.
But I think they're two different questions. But I think where the question wants to go is the misconception mm-hmm. and the common misconception. And I think over the past few years, there's a lot of new words that came to existence. And I think their propagation has been faster than the understanding of their underlying definition. Mm-hmm. For example, the word blockchain is certainly one very popular. And I have seen countless of pitch decks where decentralization, incorruptibility, and immutability are presented as a fait accompli. And this means that people expect this to be a switch on that you could buy off the shelf. I think same applies to words such as a digital asset, crypto asset, cryptocurrencies, tokenization, etc. Overall, I'd say that there's an underappreciation of how Bitcoin works, how it is. And I think until someone has a deep understanding of Bitcoin, it'll be very hard to distinguish with the rest. And the risk is to surf on the unsubstantiated yet easy to consume and repeat marketing narratives. So to summarize the question, I think that the understanding of the unforgeable costliness and the proof of work at a level where the energy consumption is understood as a feature is not only essential, it's desirable. So I would therefore recommend to start learning about this concept before listening to any sales pitch that put ahead concepts of incorruptibility, immutability of digital ledgers.
Perfect. Yeah. Okay. Yes. You made the point. I want to talk to you about a little bit about the fundamental freedoms within Bitcoin. I think there was also this talk about, you know, Bitcoin is text, information, speech. And do you want to talk about, like, what is your perspective or position on fundamental freedoms of Bitcoin or within Bitcoin or with Bitcoin?
Bitcoin is a language. Like it communicates. It's there's no time where it doesn't stop to be text. Like it's a way to communicate our preference. Particular properties linked to money, because it comes, it is valuable because it comes, the information space come in a limited supply, but it is a communication, how we express, like where people are spontaneously using, like it emerge. And yes, it has a ramification to fundamental human rights. It's the sovereignty over money, and it's a deep topic. I recommend right. on that there's an author I very respect. His work is the avatar name is Beautyon.
Oh yeah,
well, okay. Beautyon's work is I haven't read it all, but what I've read from him, I think he's the fundamentals are there.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that people, whatever background they have, like have a different, like a difficulty understanding or comparing like a purely digital or virtual gold, as I would call Bitcoin, with absolute scarcity versus either, you know, physical gold or this the centralized fiat money? Because most people think, you know, the fiat money by itself is digital. But what most people, I think, don't understand is that it's purely centralized. So what's the differentiation, do you think? Or do people make differentiation? What's their comprehension process, do you think?
Are you asking me to contrast fiat money, gold, and Bitcoin?
Not you, but what do you think, what people have difficulty understanding, the, you know, when it comes to the monetary properties, you know, absolute scarcity, but because, you know, Bitcoin is purely digital, virtual, versus other, you know, let's say hard money, like gold, like, you know, because we used to have a gold standard, but that's a long time ago.
I think people have difficulty understanding money in the first place, so that's why these concepts can be foreign, and like money in the bank account is just entries in a database, right? Mm-hmm. And then you have the physical money. I've seen there's a Quebec economist who did in a mainstream media an opinion where he's a PhD, and he said. And that adds to the public confusion. He said, $20 will always be $20 because it's backed by the central bank. And I was like, whoa, wait a minute. Like that's the nominal value. Like, yeah, that's the face value. But $20 in the 70s was probably buying grocery for four people for a week. And now you can barely get a steak for $20. So understanding the nominal, the real, the purchasing power, the limited supply is, how things work is not easily accessible. But the price, the inflation component in the asset is experienced, maybe not understood, but people see it. As far as contrasting the properties between Bitcoin and gold, I think it's important to understand that gold has ornamental usage and industrial usage, but its value is significantly more than that. And it is, as you can see from an ETF such as GLD in the US, where they claim to have physical gold backing the ETF. And if I contrast with Bitcoin, I think that there's a case to be made that Bitcoin is even rarer than gold, because there's no potential to find new Bitcoin out of nowhere, or dig a hole somewhere where there's new Bitcoin, or receive a meteorite where there's new gold on top of it. Like, there's no unexpected supply. I think it's more transportable, meaning that if you want to carry, I'm saying 100 million worth of gold, like, it's going to take trucks and it's going to be heavy to transport. And Bitcoin is digitally native. It was born in the digital, so it can be cryptographically verified. It is cheap to produce. It is expensive to produce and cheap to verify. It is programmable, and these are features that gold doesn't have.
Right, and then there are some other points, like the potential risk or danger of confiscatability, or essaying validating the purity of gold. I mean, we were not there yet where everybody, I mean, could have maybe an app or some kind of, you know, small high-tech device to validate or essay the purity of the gold. And then how do you use it in medium exchange to the grocery store, you know? So all these things, I think, are...
All these things, but to verify the gold, jewelry maker have a little liquid. And there's a little trick where you can test the purity of gold and tell you if it's how refined the gold is. But you're absolutely true that if you go for a big size, what how do you confirm that you don't have tungsten brick, gold plated tungsten brick? You know, it's the counterfeitability. And then when you use a financial product, how do you audit that there's truly all the gold that they see there is? So it's with Bitcoin, don't trust, verify. It's cryptographically verifiable, and I think there are properties to Bitcoin that are not yet fully understood or appreciated.
Right. And we already had those cases, right, where we had tungsten or it was just not pure. I mean, these things are like, I don't know, in the practical day-to-day life, sure, you know, we could go to a high-tech or to a gold merchant, and I'm sure they have all these high-tech devices. But anyway, it's just a lot of obstacles and challenges when it comes to gold. And for me, I mean, for me personally, I think the absolute transparency, absolute scarcity of Bitcoin, and of course transparency, versus the relative scarcity, is one of the key features, one of the unique features of Bitcoin. Would you agree?
I agree with that.
So you also talked in your articles about disruptive technologies. Do you think that the problems, the really root problems, are so systemic in the financial, you know, capital investment world, that it's just really difficult to integrate this into the old system? So there is no, as Buckminster Fuller said, you know, we have to create new structures and systems, mm-hmm. somehow like that, in order to make the old ones obsolete. How bad is it? I mean,
well, I rarely talk about shitcoins, but then I have no choice but to talk about shitcoins to illustrate a point. And I'm not a big fan of that, okay? But I will use that to illustrate a point. There was an ICO, initial coin offering, bubble attached to a blockchain bubble, like, where there was lots of capital. The only nice thing I can say about that whole era is that if you remove like the 95% the scams and like the Wild West, this was, I think, the legit entrepreneurs sent a message to securities regulators saying, we want to operate globally, and there is no global mechanism for crowdfunding. So what I'm trying to say is, when you look at the ecosystem and how our world are the digitalized right now, spontaneous team can form with like-minded individual who want to create and develop. And it doesn't matter where you are. Like, you may be in Austria with someone from Texas, and then me in Canada, and having someone from wherever in the world. But how do we form capital? How do we get organized while being with our respective regulation? So where your question is, how is like innovation permissible, possible? when you have so many individual regulatory bodies in all the individual jurisdiction, with all each people having to justify their work, and they will all want to have a say, it's a no-go zone. It will never happen. Even if the SEC, like last week, Commissioner Esther Pierce suggested like a three-year grace period. Well, even there, like that's just the SEC. It's another way of permissioning, like deciding ahead of time who will be the winner and the losers. And that's not right. That's not our innovation. You cannot have true innovation when you permission the thing. Mm-hmm. I think investor protection, consumer protection is very important. I don't want to dismiss that because there was lots of scams and stupid things. But
then on the other hand, you said in your article, the regulators just don't care. I mean, it seems to be, right? They don't care.
let me try to put the things in perspective and offer a very direct, hold on, let me just find one thing. Sorry for the interruption, because I have this.
Because you also talked in the context of no full fee transparency. There is a lot of complexity made to look, whoever these agents
Let me walk you through the fintech strategy, okay? Mm-hmm. So I'm taking just this macro, big picture without going into any specifics, okay? Thing is, if you look at the ecosystem, let's say fintechs want to do a strategy as an idea. Great. Regulators are paid in the equivalent of billable hours. So they have a vested interest in studying, consulting, doing more consulting, roundtables, invitation to discuss stakeholders, blah, blah, blah. This goes around for years. There's no accountability. It goes around for years. And then zoom that at all the individual region, all the individual regulators. It's insane. Then bankers profit from this because, at least in my region, it's an oligopoly. Like there are other regions where the barriers to entries are lower, but in my region, and I think in the UK it's the same, there are few dominant players. So the dominant players, that when there's oligopolistic, cartel-like environment, they profit. So they benefit from the opacity and the length. So both regulators and bankers have a common vested interest of just slowing things down. Yet the end customer has no transparency. In Canada, I find it funny that there are more regulatory bodies for financial institution than there are financial institution to choose from by a multiple. There are more regulators than there are bankers. It's crazy.
Incredible.
So end customer do not have transparency because and fintech who wants to innovate must ask permission. But then try to do something global. You will have to ask like international permission. There's probably like 86,345,62 with the individual regulation. It makes absolute no sense. So the administrative burden, the incentive to slow things down equals fintechs can't win. They can't create. And that's why I was really ripe when I heard about Bitcoin and Vires in Numeris, don't trust, verify, do your own research. I was just right. And I invite the fintechs who are frustrated and they realize that they can't create in the legacy system to join Bitcoin. And there are spontaneous teams around the world. So, and it's the most interesting topic ever. May this fail? Yeah, but I think it's quite advanced. I think it's quite advanced, quite unique, and underappreciated. And I think that this couldn't be created from within. It had to come from without.
Mm-hmm.
And right. Because innovator's dilemma. Like if you're sitting on this massive status quo and you have a big check that comes in every 2 weeks, you have no incentive to disrupt any of this. You just want things to continue the way they were. And that's why innovation inevitably comes from outside, I think.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, what conditions should happen, and there are, you know, there is a high probability, you know, said by experts that, you know, whether there's going to be a crash or, you know, bank insolvency in Europe, in Germany, or maybe even, you know, because of external conditions, whatever that is, you know, do you think the old structure could become by itself obsolete? Because I see no other way. I mean, when we look at the structural problems, beginning with the Bank for International Settlements, central banks, you know, the financial industry, it's so compartmentalized and so complex, or made so complex, as you say, you know, that we have, I see no other choice than to create or that sort of spontaneous emergence of circular economy, circular financial industry within and on Bitcoin. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, where I'm going with this? Like to make the old structures obsolete, there is no other choice than to create new structures on and within Bitcoin. Does that make sense, what I'm saying?
No, I agree. I agree with you. And I think from a macro perspective, it's very, very, very interesting times. And Bitcoin is all-in-one payment technology, savings technology, embedded currency, global, 24/7, permissionless, it's all that. And when you look at the legacy system, which is not yet understood by everyone as the legacy system, but it's antiquated, fragmented, slow, and with a monetary system that leads to boost and bust cycles. So even if you remove the existence of Bitcoin as an alternative to that, I think that the fiatist or the regular monetary system will continue to do what it does. It'll pump money until it breaks. And I don't know how long this can take, but it is the destination that's been seen many times in the previous boost and bust. And I think that the central bankers and all the nomenclatures for money printing is not as effective as they would have liked. They're not meeting their inflation target, no matter the existence of Bitcoin. Like, if you remove that and you just look like their means are not working anymore, and I think they have a conundrum. Then at the end of last year, Christine Lagarde, a few days before she became the president of the ECB, the European Central Bank, said something quite harsh in defense of negative interest rates. She said that people should be happier to have a job than to have savings rates. I was like, whoa. That's an illustration of the severity of the situation.
We couldn't believe what we were hearing. It was just incredible. It was like, you know, subservient. We are subservient slaves. We should be thankful, you know, to have a job at least, you know. So, I mean, it's...
Well, it didn't. That comment didn't really resonate very well with me. But when I look at Europe, I see that negative in German banks are negative interest rate is like a direct money confiscation. And it's not at all a good sign, because negative interest rate can accelerate the very problem it's trying to solve.
And it's legalized theft, right, Elizabeth? I mean, this is it. There's no
it's money
word.
Confiscation. There's no say it's money confiscation, right? So, but this will accelerate. Like, the more negative you go, right, people will pull their money out of the bank and will look for alternative, which will fuel hard assets and so on and so forth. So it's really not the positive. But all these tools, which includes negative interest rate, QE, liquidity injection, etc., it all means the same thing, money printing. And this is just the normal trajectory of the fiat money system. What I don't know is how much external shocks it can withhold. Because what I mean is the fiat monetary system is debt-based. For it to work, growth is needed. And there's one current area of concern that could bring the perfect storm. It's the coronavirus.
Yeah, I was going to mention that, but I thought, you know, let's leave it out. It might make things complicated. But it's already happening. It's already happening. The trade, here, I mean, trade and commerce, and it just.
Well,
just,
here are here's the angle with coronavirus and the monetary policy and the digital currency, where I see this all links together. I think first, in terms of economic growth, I think we'll be real life stress testing the supply chain So this may create an economic slowdown in both China and its international trading partners. The debt is to be seen, but again, the monetary system needs growth. Second, there's another element this time is it can be the perfect storm to force people to adopt the digital yuan. The central China has been for a long time rumored to be working on central bank digital currency, and they already have this digital closed-end loop ecosystem. And now, since the virus can live up to 9 days, what a great culprit to blame for not using paper notes anymore, and to onboard people. So I think central banks around the world, for different reasons, are realizing this, and it has a major impact on geopolitics and monetary policy transmission. So we don't know yet the net, it doesn't change the underlying fundamental difference between soft and hard money. Mm-hmm. But I think it changes lots of things from a technological point of view, political and a political global form of money, and also just how we live, like the data generated with money. So that I wouldn't dismiss the coronavirus and link to central bank digital currency faster onboarding than expected.
Okay, so we're on the same page. I wrote a couple of quotes. Banks have an implicit kill switch on innovative projects. So you said it's a profound ethical matter. So yeah, you touched on that already. I think making complexity look smart. And so we're already almost at the end. Do you want to is there anything? We can't make predictions, but where do you see in the next 5 to 10 years the ecosystem around and within Bitcoin, or where do you see Bitcoin in 5 to 10 years?
Oh, Bitcoin in 5 to 10 years, I think it will be well and alive. It will have evolved. There will be more services created, and lots of cool things. There'll be lots of cool things. Bitcoin, that an antiquated pre-internet backend fragmented financial system cannot offer. I think that the millennials are getting more, are aging. Millennials are aging, and they're getting into the place of their career where they have energy and desire to build. And I think there will be lots of cool things happening in the ecosystem, in terms of services to serve people who want to use Bitcoin, and it can transform. Once you have a new form of money, then you can develop business around that new form of money to receive, to exchange, to scale, and so on and so forth. I think this innovation can occur.
Do you see in the next decades to come? I mean, most probably, nation states per se, or governments, central banks will not be totally obsolete, probably. I don't know, maybe. I mean, it could happen. But do you see something really transformational structurally from within?
It's too big of a call for me to make. I think the entrenched interests have lots of time to waste, and lots of money to waste, and lots of connected, lots of vested interest for things to stay. But what I think could accelerate the onboarding is external shocks, right? Mm-hmm. Like external shocks, the populism, both right and left, what it does, the money printing helps those that are closer to the money printing. Mm-hmm. And this has an impact on the rest of the people. So thinking that this is going to go on and they're going to print money and inflate asset and do negative interest rates, and people start losing their job and stuff like that, it's going to go all lovey-dovey, I don't think so. And and some of the people may in time say, okay, why didn't you tell me about Bitcoin? What is this again? You told me that this was a Ponzi scheme. Can we review the definition of a Ponzi scheme, because that doesn't seem right. So I think people will be asking questions, and I think if from what I'm observing, there's a very there's very smart people involved in Bitcoin and hardworking people that are absolutely passionate. And
Yeah, I'm happy to see. I'm really fortunate. It's fortunate enough. There's, like, you know, really. I don't know. I see only a handful of people like you coming from the legacy or macro investors, like, what's his name? Like Raoul Paul and Tim Draper, I think it's his name. Or, you know, like, there is not so many people right now in, you know, in the macro investment world, financial world, that really grasp the bigger picture and the essence and the implications of Bitcoin for, you know, globally.
Oh, there are some. I've identified a few other CFA charter holders like myself who took the time, to form an opinion. Mm-hmm. But it is not. I have long studies, and I'm by design or by training an analyst. So I mm-hmm. need to understand the various parts, and it takes a long time to really study the parts. And I don't think legacy finance people have that time or that luxury, because they're running in their rat race, and they have dismissed the phenomenon because they were told that it was about blockchain and Bitcoin is bad and blockchain is good. And I think they were misled from the start. So let's not lose hope that traditional finance people will get to an understanding of that, but it's not going to happen by magic, right?
Right.
Doesn't happen. So finance people, it doesn't happen by osmosis. They will need to invest time.
Mm-hmm. Since you're an analyst, I mean, what do you think? Just for conclusion, what do you think about what is the halvenings, the stock to flow ratio? Do you have do you want to give a brief opinion? Like, what do you think gonna do to the Bitcoin price?
I don't comment on price.
On the hardness.
On the hardness. Well, look at the stock to flow ratio. If you understand that, then the logical conclusions should come naturally.
Okay, good. All right. Fascinating. Okay, Elizabeth, I'm pretty much finished with my questions. Do you have anything else important for my listeners that, you know, you want to direct them to? I mean, I already recommended to my listeners to definitely read your articles. It's really super succinctly written, and for comprehension, it's like super easy to get into, like, the bigger picture. Is there anything like your any informational resources you want to direct?
Well, I have a weekly newsletter that I write every Saturday or Sunday, depending on how my weekend goes. So it's a weekly newsletter where I comment on the stuff and share links I found pertinent in my weekly reading. So it's free, and it's available to whoever wants to receive content ideas. And also on my my website, when I produce a new blog post, I also advertise them on my weekly newsletter. I would also say to those who deal with financial advisor, I would say keep the answers closely to when you've asked about Bitcoin, and keep the answers you received somewhere. It would be interesting to look at them in a few years' time.
Sure. Well, thank you so much, Elizabeth. I hope to get you back soon, and hope to see you maybe, I know it didn't work out maybe for the Value of Bitcoin Symposium in Vienna, but I'm sure Daniel Wingen of the Value of Bitcoin Conference, he was going to get in touch with you regarding June Value of Bitcoin Conference. So hopefully we're going to see each other and have a maybe personal podcast with my professional equipment. And yeah, thank you so much for your, you know, sharing your knowledge and your expertise with all of us.
Thank you for your time. It was a pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Bye. Have a good day. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right. What you make of this? It was really, really enjoyed our talk with Elizabeth Prefontaine of Octonomics.com. Check out her website on Octonomics.com. Subscribe to her newsletter, and check out on Twitter. The Twitter handle is EPREFON, Eprefon. And yeah, if you have any questions, please write me an email to hello@thetotalconnector.com. Please share, like, subscribe, follow me. Also do that for Elizabeth Prefontaine. She's got really highly valuable knowledge and information and research done, and it's really worth every second you would spend on reading these beautiful articles. Anyway, thank you so much for supporting, for listening, and I'll talk to you soon again. Bye-bye.